From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, France mourns victims of the Paris massacre.
Barbarism won't kill the voice of people, of citizens who believe in freedom of speech.
Were the Paris terrorists acting as so-called lone wolves? Divers try to retrieve the flight recorder from the downed Air Asia flight. And emergency needs grow in Iraq as winter bites. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. France marks a day of mourning for the deaths of at least 12 people in Wednesday's shooting attack in central Paris. Flags are flying at half-staff today. Schools have been closed, and security has been stepped up around the Paris area following the country's deadliest terrorist attack in decades. The country held a minute of silence at midday. Lisa Bryant reports from Paris.
Authorities believe the attack was motivated by radical Islam. The older brother, Sharif, served prison time a few years ago for his involvement in a network sending fighters to Iraq.
C'est qu'il s'agissait de deux individus très déterminés qui incontestablement, comment dire les choses.
Interviewed on French radio Thursday morning, Prime Minister Manuel Valls said both suspects were known to intelligence services. He described them as acting like soldiers. Right now, he said, France is faced with an unprecedented terrorist menace. Both the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda have threatened France in recent months. France held a minute of silence at midday. On Wednesday, tens of thousands of French staged peaceful rallies around the country. Jean-François Jouan grew up with Charlie Hebdo's cartoonists who were among those killed on Wednesday.
I'm here to show support to this wonderful team and to show that we are for the freedom of speech, the freedom of expression, and barbarism won't kill the voice of people, of citizens who believe in freedom of speech.
France has a long history in dealing with terrorism, stretching back to the 1990s when Algerian terrorists staged bombing attacks on Paris subways. More recently, more than 1,000 French nationals have headed to Iraq and Syria to join jihadist movements. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Greg Barton of the Center for Islam and Modern World at Australia's Monash University told VOA's Victor Beatty he believes the gunmen in Paris were acting as so-called lone wolves, not at the behest of any specific terrorist organization.
The definition point here is whether they act as part of an organization following central command or whether they're acting spontaneously of their own volition. And it's not a clear demarcation. The 7/7 attacks in July 2005, the London subway system, involved four people acting fairly autonomously. They, you know, begin to look like lone wolf attackers. More recently, we've seen in France attacks by Mohamed Merah in 2002 in the south of France, in Toulouse and Montbanne. And then last year, Mehdi Namouche, a French national, shooting dead four people in a Jewish museum in Brussels. Those are classic lone wolf attacks. This appears to be of the same kind, but it's a level of sophistication we don't normally think of as associated with lone wolf attacks.
One police official is quoted by the Associated Press as saying they were linked to a Yemeni terrorist organization, and a witness said he heard one quote, "You can tell the media that it's Al-Qaeda in Yemen."
That's right. The woman who was forced to key in the door code for them, they threatened to shoot her infant daughter, said that they said, "We are acting in the name of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula." This is that affiliate of Al-Qaeda, known to be most aggressive in attempting to launch foreign attacks. But in the past, their attempts, such as the bombing of the flight into Detroit Christmas Day 2009, the so-called underwear bombing, involved explosive devices. So this would be an innovation to be using assault weapons if indeed it's proven that there is this link. But even then, it's not clear whether this was centrally planned by AQAP or whether these people took it upon themselves to do this in the name of AQAP. We think that they had experience fighting with Al-Qaeda affiliates in Syria, where they were further radicalized and where they learned how to use these assault weapons so effectively. So this classification of lone wolf or organized terror attack is an important point of distinction, and it's not clear at this moment.
You mentioned Islamic State fighters returning from Iraq and Syria. Does Europe have a growing problem with regard to these fighters, and what can be done about it?
The entire world has a growing problem with these foreign fighters, but it's particularly a problem in Europe. It's not clear the number of people who have travelled from America to fight with Syria in Syria and Iraq, but it may be of the order of 100. In the case of France, it's closer to 1,000. In the case of the UK, more than 600. So very large numbers. Admittedly, France has a Muslim population of around 5 million. Most of whom, of course, are well-integrated and very moderate. But it has a lot of disgruntled young men who are being radicalized through a life in petty crime, time in prison, and then joining up with groups and fighting abroad. And that fits what we know about the alleged gunmen, the two brothers involved in this attack, fits with the pattern of people like Mehdi Namush last year and Mohamed Merah in 2012.
European states are assessing their threat levels. Of course, France has raised it to its highest level. How can European governments respond?
There's no easy answers here. There's no singular solutions. This office of the magazine Charlie Hebdo was secured behind a locked door, had a police guard. That wasn't enough. I mean, it had been attacked by firebombers in 2011, so there was reason to keep it under high security. Al-Qaeda had its editor on its watch list and threatened to kill him in a issue of its magazine Inspire, linked with AQAP, back in 2013. So these people were as secure as you could reasonably make a group of journalists working in a professional environment. So that's not going to be the answer. Intelligence is our best line of defense. The most important element of intelligence is human intelligence, and that really depends upon good relations with communities. Still no guarantees there, but a better chance of being forearmed that somebody is about to try and do something if you're sort of plugged into community networks.
Barton says modern terrorist organizations launch such outrageous attacks in hopes of inflaming anti-immigrant sentiments against Muslims, which in turn makes Muslim communities feel threatened, thereby radicalizing young Muslim men, making them ripe for recruitment in jihadist groups. The United States is condemning the terror attack in Paris, and officials are promising to help in any way possible. VOA's Jeff Selden reports from the Pentagon.
Meeting with his vice president and secretary of state, President Barack Obama praised France as America's oldest ally and offered U.S. help to hunt down those who carried out the attack.
Our counterterrorism cooperation with France is excellent. We will provide them with every bit of assistance that we can.
Earlier, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry warned terrorists the U.S. and France will never give in.
Today's murders are part of a larger confrontation, not between civilizations, no, but between civilization itself and those who are opposed to a civilized world.
At the Pentagon, another offer of support from spokesman Colonel Steve Warren.
A horrific, terrible attack. There is no place among free people for this type of barbarism, and we stand with our allies. We stand absolutely ready to assist the French in any way.
Warren says the Pentagon is not aware of specific threat streams right now, and there have been no requests from France for any military assistance. U.S. Homeland Security officials also say they're closely monitoring the events, but add there's no change to America's security posture. The U.S. Embassy in Paris also remains open. Jeff Selden, VOA News, The Pentagon.
Speaking in the House of Commons Wednesday, British Prime Minister David Cameron addressed the Paris attack.
I know that this House and this country stands united with the French people in our opposition to all forms of terrorism, and we stand squarely for free speech and democracy. And these people will never be able to take us off those values.
At the United Nations, Secretary General Ban Ki-moon spoke with reporters.
This horrific attack is meant to divide. We must not fall into that trap. This is a moment for solidarity around the world. We must stand strong for freedom of expression and tolerance and stand against the forces of division and hate.
The Committee to Protect Journalists called the shooting the worst on the media since the 2009 massacre in the Philippines, in which 57 people, including journalists, were killed. Muslim leaders in France have also denounced the shooting. A member of Vietnam's National Assembly has been arrested over an alleged real estate scam. Marianne Brown reports from Hanoi.
Police searched the home of 49-year-old Cho Thị Thu Nga for several hours Wednesday, seizing an undisclosed number of documents. She was arrested over alleged fraud involving a housing project run by her private company. The company collected deposits from 80 potential home buyers between 2009 and 2010, worth a total of $14 million, but did not pay them back when the project did not materialise, a report in Tang Nian newspaper said. It was expected to be finished by the end of 2015. Nguyen Minh Thuyết, former deputy chairman of the National Assembly's Committee on Culture, Education and Youth, said some negative information about Nga began circulating at the beginning of the Assembly election process in 2011.
Bởi vì những cái thông tin bất lợi cho bà Thu Nga thì nó đã xuất hiện ngay từ cái lúc.
However, he says relevant agencies probably did not investigate this thoroughly, and the electorate voted her in. She was suspended on Wednesday from her position as a member of the National Assembly's Committee on Finance and Budget. Lawmakers in Vietnam are allowed a level of immunity from prosecution, as Dick Xuân Thảo, chairman of the National Assembly's Legislative Research Institute, explained in an interview with state broadcaster VTV on Thursday.
Nếu mà theo quy định của hiến pháp, thì như tại điều 81.
He says, according to the Constitution, no one is allowed to arrest, detain, or prosecute a deputy without approval from the National Assembly. In Nga's case, chairman of the Assembly, Nguyen Sinh Hung, gave permission for investigation agencies to go ahead. The government has been carrying out a crackdown on corruption in recent years amid economic woes, with several high-profile trials, some of which have resulted in the death penalty. Observers often connect the arrests of prominent business figures with political infighting in the Communist Party. Deputy Thuyết said he believed this was not the case with Nga. Police gathered enough evidence against her, he says, and have already arrested her partners. Vietnam is rated 119 out of 175 countries in Transparency International's Corruption Perception Index 2014, ranking it ahead of Cambodia and Myanmar, but behind Thailand, Indonesia and China. This is Marianne Brown for VOA News in Hanoi.
Indonesian rescue teams have been struggling with turbulent and murky seas in a bid to retrieve the black box data recorder from the tail section of the crashed Air Asia plane identified a day earlier. As Ron Corbin reports from Bangkok, despite intense rescue efforts, just a quarter of the bodies of the more than 160 passengers and crew on board have been recovered.
Indonesian authorities, backed by an international team of more than 80 Navy divers, were hoping Thursday to raise the tail section containing the black box of the downed AirAsia flight from the bottom of the Java Sea. Despite discovering the plane's tail section Wednesday on the sea floor about 30 metres deep, divers struggled to reclaim the flight data recorder, which is considered critical to determining what happened in the December 28 crash. Vessels with heavy lifting cranes are on standby waiting to raise the section from the seabed. But search efforts remain hampered by murky waters, rough seas and poor weather conditions stirred by monsoon storms since the rescue was launched. Search teams have recovered baggage and smaller parts of the plane, including seats and an emergency door. The plane's wreckage appears to have broken up into four major portions. Henry Bambang Solistio, chief of Indonesia's search and rescue agency, told reporters that recovery plans would continue after locating the tail section. He said searchers were trying to confirm the black box was still in the wreckage or had become detached. Authorities said Thursday that if the flight recorder is damaged, it could take 2 weeks to recover the data. So far, about 40 bodies of the 162 passengers and crew have been retrieved. 24 of them have been positively identified. Anton Castellani, chief of Indonesia's disaster victim identification team, said more bodies were found Thursday and would be transferred to the Indonesian city of Surabaya for formal identification.
We're still working on DNA of the rest. Waiting for identification process for the rest. And From Pangkalanbun, I got information that they got another four dead bodies from the sea. I do believe that if they can find a big part of the plane, I hope that they can find more dead bodies inside of the plane. Hope so.
Castellani said despite concerns over the advanced stage of decomposition of the bodies, forensic teams were trained using DNA and other sources to identify the victims. The AirAsia tragedy in the early hours of December 28 came on a routine two-hour flight from Surabaya City to Singapore. Initial analysis by Indonesia's meteorological department said monsoon storms were a key contributing factor for the accident. Aviation industry observers say severe cold and icing caused the engines to stall. The Indonesian Transport Ministry has also launched an investigation into the accident, saying AirAsia was not cleared to fly from Surabaya to Singapore on Sundays, but had permission on four other days of the week. But AirAsia's chief executive officer, Tony Fernandez, has disputed the claims, saying the airline was cleared to fly the route 7 days a week. The tragedy is the first for the Malaysia-based low-cost carrier. Fernandez launched the airline in 2002, now with more than 160 aircraft and subsidiaries in at least three Asian countries, including Indonesia. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
The International Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies are appealing for $19 million to provide emergency winter assistance to nearly 500,000 displaced people who have fled from militant Islamist attacks to Erbil and Duhok in Iraq's Kurdish region. Lisa Schlein reports from Red Cross headquarters in Geneva.
Temperatures have pummeled to below 0 degrees Celsius in many regions of Iraq, especially in Kurdistan's snow-covered mountainous areas, where hundreds of thousands of displaced Iraqis are living. Spokesman for the International Red Cross Federation, Benoit Macha Carpentier, tells VOA these people do not have access to food, to water, to health, and to many other basic services. He says they are unprepared and ill-equipped to survive the winter frost.
Conditions are very, very difficult. A lot of them have been moving quite a couple of times, so a lot of them have lost all their assets, whether they've lost them in the move or they had to sell them because they didn't have enough money to just buy basic necessities or even food. A lot of them don't have proper shelter, so that's one of the activities we will be focusing on.
Masha Carpentier says health is one of the biggest concerns. He says the health infrastructure in the region has completely broken down and must be restored, otherwise these vulnerable people are at great risk of acquiring illnesses. He says they are completely defenseless. They have no means of fighting off disease and other health problems.
It's a accumulation of issues. When people don't have food, they don't have shelter, they don't have access to health, and of course they are much more at risk of illness because of all these factors. So we need to make sure that they have a roof on their head and that they can eat at least a proper one meal per day and that they can have access to water, which is a big gap.
Nearly half of Iraq's 2 million internally displaced people have fled to the Kurdish regions. The others are living in the central and southern regions of the country, many of them in areas controlled by the so-called Islamic State. Since the fighting erupted, Masha Carpentier says more than 4,000 volunteers of the Iraqi Red Crescent Society have been at the forefront of relief operations throughout the country. He says they are providing basic items, first aid, and psychological support to those affected by the violence. He says money from the $19 million emergency appeal will allow this army of humanitarian volunteers to continue to respond to the vital needs of the hundreds of thousands of homeless people who often are living in life-threatening conditions. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Researchers have a new lead on why HIV has been so hard to cure and a potential new strategy for driving the virus from one of its last major hiding places in the body. VOA's Steve Barragona has the story.
Patients can live for decades with HIV infection as long as they take antiviral drugs that stop the virus from making copies of itself, known as replicating. But the virus is never gone. It lies dormant in a part of the immune system called resting memory T cells, making it basically invisible to the body's defenses. But Johns Hopkins University HIV researcher Robert Silicano says,
as soon as patients stop taking the drugs, virus comes out of this latent state and starts to replicate again. And that's why you can't cure anybody with the drugs.
Silicano spoke to VOA by Skype. He says doctors have hoped that if they can decloak the virus while the patient is taking antivirals, the body's own defenses would spot the infected cells and destroy them, and the drugs would keep the newly awakened virus from spreading. But so far, that has not worked. Writing in the journal Nature, Silicano and colleagues found one reason.
Almost all of this virus that's in a latent form has mutated in a way that makes it able to escape.
HIV is a master of disguise, like a spy on the run. Secret agents can change their coat and color their hair. They might duck into a closet until the coast is clear. Likewise, HIV is constantly mutating to evade the immune system. That's where the drugs come in. If the virus fools the body's germ hunters, called killer T cells, the antiviral drugs can still kill it, except for the altered virus that has gone into hiding in the memory T cells. The new study found that when the virus comes out of hiding, nearly all of it is mutated, still wearing a disguise that most of the killer T cells do not recognize. Most, but not all. And that's the key.
There are other cells that see different parts of the virus that have not mutated. And those cells still can be effective. Now, they have to be stimulated in the right way. But once they're stimulated, they can now recognize and eliminate these infected cells.
Silicano showed this smaller group of killer T cells a piece of the virus that had not changed. That stimulated them to find and kill most of the infected memory T cells. It's like training spy hunters to look for the secret agent's shoes. It's good news, but Siciliano cautions it's too soon to celebrate.
Whether they would ever kill enough of them, you know, to allow the patient to go off treatment and not have the virus come back, we don't know.
But according to virologist David Margolis at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, who was not involved in the research, it's a brighter assessment than a study Silicano published just a few years ago.
It sort of painted a darker picture, like it would be very hard or impossible to get rid of latently infected cells. It does look pretty straightforward to think of ways that we could retarget the immune response to actually clear that virus.
But, he adds, there are major hurdles to clear before scientists can talk about a cure for HIV. Silicano agrees.
Half the battle is killing the cells once, you know, you turn the virus back on. Probably the harder part is actually just turning the virus back on. We still, you know, are looking for ways to do that.
Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
According to the World Health Organization, 128 million people were infected with malaria in 2013, a year that saw 584,000 die, most of them under the age of five. And now, Lanshin, a London-based tech startup firm, claims that its X-Rapid app for smartphones and an attachable microscope case could significantly increase diagnosis rates. Jean Varie-Babil is the company's chief executive.
The problem to solve is how to diagnose malaria quickly and cheaply. This is a mobile microscope, 200-time microscope, with a constant source of light attached to an iPhone or an Android device, any of them. And we use the combined power of the smartphone's camera and the smartphone processing power to read a malaria slide like a biologist would do, just faster and more efficiently. And therefore, we can diagnose malaria on the spot where it's needed. And the faster you diagnose, the faster you can treat it.
The WHO said in West Africa, the Ebola outbreak has had a devastating impact on malaria treatment and the rollout of malaria control programs. In Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia, all severely hit by the Ebola epidemic, many inpatient clinics are closed and attendance at outpatient facilities is a fraction of rates seen before the outbreak. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest news at voanews.com any old time you feel like it. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington.